Hey guys, welcome back to the Real Estate Monopoly. My name is Kerwin.
And this is Jeffrey.
And we are the Donis Brothers. Today we have an awesome guest who we met at an event not that long ago because we love going out there and meeting people at networking events. Jeffrey, do you remember the last networking event we went to?
I do. I don't think it was a Charlotte one.
I think it was the Charlotte one, which is where we met our next guest.
Yeah. I think it was like on a rooftop deck somewhere in Charlotte.
Yes. And you were so popular and everyone was trying to get around you. So we were very lucky and fortunate to get at least like a few minutes with you and a picture, a selfie. It was a little blurry, but it was perfect. Thank you again, Kathy. Please, can you introduce yourself to the audience and then I'll go into your bio.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I'm Kathy Fedke, co-founder of Real Wealth. My husband is now the CEO. I was CEO for years, but he's taking over because I've been doing a lot of podcasts and TV appearances. But we've developed Real Wealth. It's an investor group that has almost 70,000 members now that we educate for free at our website and also connect them with teams nationwide where they can buy rental property.
Yeah, that's perfect. And Kathy specializes in teaching people how to build multi-million dollar real estate portfolios through creative finance and planning. She's passionate about researching and then sharing that on multiple platforms, which we're big fans of. I listen to your show every week. And so I mean, like religiously, it's one of the top shows I listen to. So it's awesome.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Absolutely. And I know you're also a frequent guest on CNN, CNBC, Fox News, NPR, and CBS Market Watch. And like you mentioned, you're the host of Real Wealth Podcast, The Real Wealth Show, and Real Estate News for Investors. And you also co-host a Bigger Pockets show on the market, which is awesome as well. So thanks again for being here. Let's jump into the good stuff. Can you briefly explain, it's a little bit of a bittersweet story when it comes to why you even started investing in real estate or got exposed to it in the first place, relating to your husband and his health. Can you maybe expand on that story and how that got you on the path of real estate investing?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you want go back in time to 2002, that's a long time ago. I was living the dream. I had two little kids. I kind of gave up my career in broadcasting. I'd been working in the newsrooms in San Francisco, but when I got married and we had children, we bought our beautiful dream home, and Rich had just come out with his book called Extreme Success. And he was touring the country, you know, doing interviews for his book. Everything was perfect. And one night I was just chopping vegetables and the kids were doing their homework and I was in bliss, and I had picked from my organic garden, you know, the vegetables, like it was the dream. Yeah. And Rich walked in and he had tears in his eyes. If you've seen Rich, which you have, like he's a big guy, he's huge. And he's an athlete, an extreme athlete. That's why the book was called Extreme Success. He's bungee jumped off of the Golden Gate Bridge, off of Half Dome. He surfs hurricane waves. Like he rock climbs. He is not somebody that cries very often unless he's happy. So he didn't look happy. He walked in and he just came over to me and gave me a hug. And he was like, his doctor told me I probably have 3 to 6 months to live. And I dropped whatever spatula I was holding. I'm like, what? He had been diagnosed with melanoma. This was nearly 20 years ago. So things were different back then. They didn't know how to cure it. And it was a quick death. You know, it spread quickly. We ended up talking to people who knew people who had it. And, you know, it was just like constant, like, oh, I lost my husband that way or my child or whatever. Like, okay, stop telling us this. So the first thing we needed to do was tune all of that out and just focus on his health and what it was going to, you know, take to overcome it. Yeah. Second, we had to figure out the finances, because if he, you know, we found out we didn't have the right insurance. We didn't have life insurance that would cover it. We didn't have health insurance that would cover it, if you could believe that. So it's amazing. You got to read the fine print, right? We thought cancer would be covered, but this particular one, we had to pay a large amount. So, you know, we had done everything we were told, that saving 10% for emergencies, investing 10%, having 10% set aside for fun, you know, the college education fund, all of the things we were doing properly. And we were high income earners, you know, at least Rich was. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time. So we blew through that savings. Mm-hmm. And it was like, what are we going to do now? So the first thing I did, you know, we had this six bedroom house that we overbought. You know, we went big, like a lot of Americans, like way overspent, went too big, had a massive mortgage payment. It was, you know, $4,500 a month, which today is a lot. But when you go back 20 years, that's like twice that. It would feel like a $10,000 a month payment. So huge mortgage. And I was like, oh man, what are we going to do? So he went rock climbing for the weekend with his friends and he came back to a full house. I rented out every nook and cranny from Craigslist. I felt bad. I just did it like without him knowing, but I turned it into a fourplex. I had the in-law suite below and then the office and this, you know, turned it into a fourplex. And then I found out you could have students. You could put four students in a room for international students and you had to feed them. So literally like packed out the house, but it covered everything. And that was the first time I learned about, you know, passive income, even though that wasn't maybe the best way to do it, but it helped. Yeah. So that was the beginning. But then also I had a weekend radio show and I thought, you know, this is, I got to use this to figure out how to create passive income. Because if the doctor was right, I didn't want to be away from my kids for 10 hours a day at some job. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom and figure out how to make money from home and ideally passively, which I don't know. I didn't know anybody who did that, but that's when I was lucky enough to interview the guy, the book behind you. I had Robert Kiyosaki on the show and that was life-changing. Yeah,
absolutely. No, and there's a lot I want to dig into there and it's very inspirational. And I think adversity tends to have a lot of impacts and we've gone through, I think everyone has their own version of adversity. So you learn a lot from that experience. And you mentioned that you had the show where I believe it was a radio show on the weekends and then you kind of transitioned it to more real estate focused with the mortgage co-host, mortgage lending co-host. So I would love to know, what did that, like, how did that come about? How did that unfold? And I also want, since you mentioned it, Robert Kiyosaki, in general, I'm sure you had a lot of awesome guests. What were some of the major takeaways from that experience?
Oh, all of it was mind blowing. I just looked at, you know, how can I make money now? And this is what a lot of people forget to look at is like, you need cash flow. You got to cover your bills before investing for the long term. You got to think about the now. So I was like, what can I do to make money now? And oftentimes what we just need to do is look at what we do best. You know, what do we enjoy? What are we great at? And even if it doesn't seem like a traditional thing, maybe that's where we need to put our energy. So because Rich and I were both personal and professional coaches at the time, that was the first thing I thought of is like, what am I good at? And what could I do fairly easily that would be fun? Well, I had this weekend show. So it was like, what can I do to make that better and to make, have it make money? And of course, sponsorships, right? That's what you do. So I thought, and I hadn't really been monetizing it. I just was doing it for fun, really. It's like, okay, who would sponsor the show? So, well, I'll listen to who's sponsoring other shows. And now this was 2000, you know, it was 2003 by then. And at the time, this was the beginning of the mortgage credit boom. So every ad was a mortgage broker. So I thought, okay, they have money. I didn't know anything about real estate, except that I just rented out every room in my house. But I just went down the phone book and called people and pitched and was like, hey, you want to sponsor my show? And it was a no, no, no. So I thought, and this is a big lesson when you're starting out, it's like, what am I doing wrong? Well, I'm just calling and asking for money. They don't know anything about me, you know? So the next step was I got to make an offer that's good for them. It's not about me. It's about them. What's going to be something they could never say no to. And so the next mortgage broker I called and I was like, how would you like to be my co-host? And he was like, yeah, you know, he's like, come to my office. Let's talk about it. So when I went there, I made the sponsorship like 10 times what I had been trying to get, but it was a much better deal. And I said, I'm going to make you a star. People are going to know your name. You're going to be the first person they think of when they think of mortgages. And he's like, yeah, you wrote the check. So that was like the first step in making money now. But then I came home and I'm like, Rich, I'm a sellout. Now I have a mortgage show. I'm going to lose my audience. This is going to be horrible. And he's like, yeah, that's funny. Cause up till then I had no interest in anything financial. I would like just dread our financial planning meetings. So I was like, well, just take care of it. But at this point I was like, okay, all right. Well, he said, why don't you find out what people are doing with these mortgages and make it human interest? So I went back to Gary, was his name. And I said, Gary, do you have interesting clients that we could interview and just kind of show what they're doing with the mortgages, and that'll sell your product rather than just telling people they can get a 3% rate or whatever. Mm. He's like, I love it. So it turns out that Gary was really into wealth building and really into the investing side of it in all the different ways that could be done. So he had all these clients. Some were doing flips, some were just buying to live in it, fix it up while they lived there for 2 years, then sell it and keep all that capital gain tax-free, you know, because if you lived in it for 2 years, you can get up to $500,000 tax-free if you're married. I was learning things like that that I'd never heard. Talking to people who were investing, and they were not just investing locally, they were investing all over the place. Just so many different ways to make money. So suddenly my show grew because these people were so interesting and they were sharing secrets that at the time was really hard to learn. Yeah. The only place you could, at the time, there weren't podcasts back then. So it was either late night TV or, you know, books or what. Like, it was really hard to get the information. There were REIAs, real estate investment groups, but those were mostly just kind of, I hate to say it, but a lot of them just ripping you off with sales. They would be like $10,000 product to learn how to do this or that. And a lot of those times they weren't really very valuable courses. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So I was opening up this world that nobody knew about. So then my partner now, he goes, Kathy, this has been far more successful than I ever thought. I can't keep up with all these mortgages. Everybody wants them. Everybody wants to invest. Could you get your license and be a mortgage broker? I'm like, yeah. And he pulls out three checks. One was 10,000, one was 11, and one was 12,000. He's like, this is what I made today. Because loans were like at the time, like it was so easy. I'd give someone an application, they fill it out, I turn it in, make 10 grand. So I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. And then the money issues were gone. And the best part of the story is that the doctor discovered that it could be cut out, you know, the melanoma, that it hadn't spread as bad as he thought. And he is healthy today. And he just had melanoma actually last week. He's walking around with stitches right now, but they catch it early and they cut it out.
That's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. This is an amazing story. Truly. I think one of my main takeaways was that you not only prioritize your education when it came to like starting out in real estate, and how the creative you got with creating your own platform and bringing those people to you is a testament to how like intentional you were with it, even at a time where podcasts weren't as readily available as they are now. I know for us, like a big advantage of having a podcast like this is getting the opportunity to speak and connect with people like you, where maybe we might not have access to on a normal basis, right?
Yeah, and leading with value as well. You didn't necessarily, like you said at the beginning, you were kind of just looking at what I can get out of it, but eventually you realize if you just tweaked it a little bit and tried to find a way to bring value to the other individual, eventually it probably played out better than what you could have imagined. So sounds like that's something that we also try to do as well, is lead with value. And typically, inherently, that'll end up, you know, leaving you better off than if you were to just look out for yourself. So thank you for sharing that. That was amazing.
100%. Yeah. Look how you can give and serve and it comes back tenfold, hundredfold.
Absolutely. And so for other newer investors, a lot of times they might not want to start a thought leadership platform, but now that times are changed, they don't really necessarily have to do that. I'd love to know, what advice do you have for somebody that might be on the fence? I know you coach people and kind of help guide them through the real estate investing process. So someone that's starting out, or maybe just like skeptical, kind of in that analysis paralysis phase. I know you've emphasized the importance of educating yourself, and it's important because it is risky and there is danger.
Yeah.
But how do you kind of mitigate the caution with the ability to take action?
It's such a great question. And oftentimes couples, married couples or people, you know, families have people who on opposite sides. So there might be someone who's like, ready, let's go, let's jump in, let's do this. And they don't need a lot of information. And then you've got a spouse maybe who's like, that's the way we were. Rich needed all the information and I just had a gut feel about things. So I would just be like, oh, why do you have to slow everything down? And he's like, why do you have to go so fast? And it caused problems in the beginning, because as soon as I had Robert Kiyosaki on the show and he told me about all the, what he was doing investing in Texas at the time, I was like, I want to get on a plane and go. I mean, I could give myself loans. I could get unlimited investor loans with no money down at the time. So I was like, I want to go do what Kiyosaki said and go to Dallas and buy 10 properties. Rich is like, so what I learned is, like, if somebody's scared or if you're scared and you have analysis paralysis or you're not moving forward, like my husband, it was simply a lack of information. That's it. You know, he wasn't doing the interviews that I was doing. He wasn't talking to the people I was talking to. He was busy doing other things. I was reading all the books of the people I was interviewing. I was loaded with information, but he didn't have it. So what I learned is, oh, if I want to, you know, be on the same page, I got to make sure he's got the information. And that's what I would say to somebody who's not sure is you just need more information. That's it. You know, you either need to talk to more people who are doing what you want to do or read more books or go, you know, I was like, Rich, just come with me, come see it. And he jumped on the plane and we went and he talked to the property managers and he walked through the houses. He just needed more information. And then he was able to sign. And we did come back with 5 properties and we went again and came back with 5 more. So that's all. You just need more information. It's not necessarily brainy information. That's mm-hmm. important too. But like he needed to see it and touch it and feel it and walk the streets and see the jobs nearby and the construction going on, you know?
Absolutely. No, I love that. I love that. And this is kind of like a follow-up question that I know you have a journalism background, and I'm really fascinated with it because in the past I've heard you mention that back when you were more involved in the actual journalism world with like CNN and all those other different news sources, there wasn't as much of a slant as there is today. But I would love to know, without getting too into it, how do you approach like educating yourself with objective information, and what advice do you have for someone on the other end that wants to find reliable sources of information?
Yeah, because I do try to read a lot of articles, mm-hmm. and it's hard for me to find. Well, it's almost like everyone has their own bias, and it's hard to find ones that aren't so obviously biased. Like you'll see exactly what side they're on. I'm just curious. Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah. Well, when I was in the news business, we were not allowed to slant. You know, there was no, you just gave the straight news. And if there was going to be a slant, it would just be you'd interview somebody with an opinion, mm-hmm. but then you had to balance it with the exact opposite opinion. So those were the good old days. And then things changed. But back then, even so, this is way off topic, but I was really upset that McDonald's had changed. They said that they got rid of partially hydrogenated oils that were causing heart attacks. And then I found out later, again, we did all these news stories on how they changed their oil. I found out later that they didn't, or that they switched back but didn't announce it. So you can look it up. It's kind of interesting, but an attorney had me be the lead plaintiff and we sued McDonald's. And won and donated the millions that we won to the Heart Association to help people. The station that I worked for, I won't say which one, when they found out I did that, I was let go. And the reason was because McDonald's was the largest sponsor of that particular news station. So I knew back then that sponsors control things, and there were certain things you couldn't do or talk about if they were paying for the show. So it was already kind of slanted in that way, that whoever's sponsoring, they get a free card, basically. You know, you're not going to be doing the reporting on them. Yeah. So I think that's what's happened today is basically, you know, politicians and news media, they're beholden to their sponsors. That's the bottom line. And we're just seeing a lot of, so you have to find out, you follow the money, find out who's paying for it and you know, what do they have to gain from it? You know? And then also, I mean, everything is slanted, even the government data, you know, you go to the government websites, you're like, oh, this must be inflation. Is it though? You know, is this the real inflation number? So for me personally, I found through Real Wealth Network, through our network, mm-hmm. one of the ways I get information is the real-time boots on the street. So when we're talking about real estate investing, one of the greatest assets that we have at Real Wealth is people. We have over 70,000 people. Many of them are investors. We have boots on the street, experts in many cities who tell us what's going on. So in March, April of 2020, when everyone's like, what's happening? And you're sitting at home and like, oh my gosh, are we going to get through this? I just thought, okay, I'm going to talk to my boots on the street. And I did daily webinars. Now the headlines were saying foreclosures are, you know, there's going to be 5 million foreclosures. I don't know if you remember that, but they're like, all these forbearances are going to lead to 5 million foreclosures. And it's always something like that. And that's what we're hearing on one side in these eviction moratoriums. You're not, you know, landlords aren't going to get their money. They're going to all go broke. So I just like, okay, every single day I did a webinar every day during the pandemic. Our team worked overtime when people were like, oh, this is great. We're resting at home. We're like, no, our team is working. We did webinars every day. And I brought on property managers every day from a different city. Like, what's going on in your city? Tell me real time. And they're like, all I know is we have a wait list of applicants and rents are going up and people are paying. It was like, what? That's not what we're hearing in the headlines. Yep. And next day it would be Florida one day, it would be Chicago the next day, it would be Detroit. Every single city had the same story. So we were like we were in front of the headline news. We were real time, like, there's not a housing collapse, guys. Something else is happening. Mm-hmm. It's actually the opposite. It's the opposite. So I have just found over time that listening to real time real estate investors is the best way to go, which is how I got my start. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm talking exactly. to real time people, talking to Robert Kiyosaki, and he's saying,
yeah.
in 2005, he's saying, this is going to fall apart. I'm selling everything in the high price markets and buying in Texas. I was like, oh, that makes sense. I'm in the mortgage industry. Yes, these loans are not, they're not going to pan out well. That's obvious. It's like, listen to the people who are out there on the street, know what they're doing and have experience. That's what I would say,
oh, that is
which
awesome.
Is what you're doing, which is what you're doing with this podcast.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I appreciate you sharing that experience. And so you kind of alluded to like the 2008 crisis and the unfolding events that happened after that. And I might have misheard on a previous podcast that you did, but you talked about how there was an experience where I believe you guys encountered some challenges during that time. And you came to an epiphany of like what was really important to you. And your company is called Real Wealth. So this is kind of like mm-hmm. a twofold question, but can you maybe touch on some of the challenges you faced during that time, how you guys realized that maybe money isn't everything, but also what do you define wealth as? How did that change?
Yeah, that's really great. So we made some really smart decisions by buying in Texas and following Kiyosaki's advice and getting out of the storm. And I'll just share what he explained is mm-hmm. you've got to follow the jobs, you've got to follow the population and go into markets that have not bubbled, that are still affordable for the average person. And that was Texas at the time. And that was really only Texas. Like mm-hmm. They had massive job growth, the highest in the country, and massive population growth, the highest in the country, but their housing hadn't gone up in value yet because they weren't allowing those crazy loans. They had very strict lending laws because of the S&L crisis of the 80s. So they weren't playing the game that everybody else was playing. So it was like a safe haven. So once I understood that, and once we invested there, and once I shared it, and then I helped thousands of people do that, then I didn't listen to my own advice. And Rich and I kept two multi-million dollar houses in California. One was the first house we bought, the one that we rented everything out. We kept that and rented it. And then we bought another house that was like a $1 million fixer. And here I was doing exactly the opposite of what I was telling people. Well, when the market turned, those $1 million houses were worth about $750,000, $800,000 each, but we had loans on them for 1.2, you know? Mm. So, and had put money into them. So just, I didn't follow my advice. And then I went to Boise, Idaho, which is a great market today, but back then there was only one or two major employers, and they just didn't have the rental pool that we did in Texas. But I kind of paid top dollar for those properties. That didn't pan out well. We had vacancies there because, you know, we weren't in a diverse job market like I was in Texas. It was just like, duh, like why didn't I? And then we did new construction in Tennessee, again, great properties, but we got into short-term loans that ballooned in a year. And I was telling everybody else getting a fixed rate, 30-year fixed rate loan, then you have nothing to worry about. And then Rich and I are going and getting these construction loans that ballooned in a year. When the market collapsed, we couldn't refi. Our credit was fine, but there was nobody who would refi because banks were failing left and right. They had no money to lend. And then they capped it at 10 loans that you could have. And we were way past that. So here we were like not following my advice. And that's why today in this kind of market, I say the same thing, get into markets, get out of the markets that bubbled. You missed it. Get out of Austin, get out of, like, don't sell now. Just don't buy now.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in a bit, it'll be more affordable in those markets, but not right now. Though they already did their thing and they're probably going to come back down. But if you're in markets, like we're in parts of Texas still where we're still buying stuff under $200,000 in areas with massive job growth. Like I don't have any worries about those areas. That's why we're starting a rental fund in North Texas in this climate.
Yeah, no, that's a really insightful experience. And to kind of follow up with the latter of the questions, how did that experience, and just like in general, your entire real estate journey, how has your definition of wealth changed? And what does wealth mean to you now?
Well, I remember when we were handing the keys back, so to speak, to the bank on those construction properties that we lost several hundred thousand on. And I just looked at Rich and, you know, in our mortgage, we were $10,000 a month, negative cash flow. Is so dumb. So dumb. I just remember looking at Rich and saying, well, you're alive. And he like none of that fazed him, because he's like, hey, I'm alive. Every day is an extra free day for me. So he's just happy every day. Honestly, yeah. He literally is the happiest person, because every day he's like, hey, I'm here. I'm still here.
Like Pitbull says, every day above ground is a great day.
It's a great day. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's happy. So it takes a lot. It would take a lot. It would take something horrible that happened to his family or his loved ones that would, you know, affect him. But he's like, money? I don't care. You know, he's like, I still, the rocks that I climb and the waves that I surf, they're still there. I can still do the things I'd love to do. He's like, I'd be happy with you if we lived in a van. He's like, I could be maybe even happier if we lived in a van and all we did was surf all day. So he's just, yeah, it was really like, what matters most? What matters most is what matters most. And that's where the focus should be.
Absolutely. And we always like to call what other people might consider a failure, we like to call learning lessons, because Rod Khalif calls them seminars. They're just so much you can take away from that experience. And along with some of the principles you mentioned, and I'm sure, Jeffrey, I don't know if you have any you want to add, but like, what are some timeless principles that you have learned and kind of accumulated throughout your investing career and that you're using now? Because the economy is always changing. It's going up or down, or, you know, cap rates are always changing, but certain principles, if you stick to them, you're able to stay disciplined.
Yeah, I would say, you know, really be cautious with debt. Debt's what takes people down. I mean, obviously, if you own anything all cash, you know, you're going to be fine as long as you can handle the taxes and the insurance and the repairs. You know, there's always cost no matter what. Taxes make real estate never free, right? It's never free and clear. You got expenses. But if you take away the debt piece, then you can usually ride through it. So that's number one. I love debt. It just needs to be debt that you can pay. So I would be very careful with short-term loans and make sure you have an exit plan for that. I know a lot of people are going to be facing some seminars coming up because they got in short-term loans and they're going to be in trouble now that rates are up. So I love the long-term debt. And when I say long-term, I'm even okay with a 5 or a 7 year, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry. No worries. You can edit this, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
No rush.
All right. Sorry about that.
No worries at all. Sorry. So you were talking about the timeless principles and debt, the issues with debt.
Yeah. Just make sure if you go into short-term debt or any kind of balloon note that you have a really, really, really solid backup plan. Mm-hmm. I much prefer longer-term debt. Even a 5, 7, or 10 year ARM, I'm okay with, because that gives you time. I much prefer a 10 or a 30 year fix, because there's just no surprises there. So definitely be cautious about debt and over leveraging. Mm-hmm. I used to be like 100%, no money down. I love the 100% loans. Now, like if I were to do a multifamily deal, I want 65% LTV. That's safe for me.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm at a different age than you guys. You could take more risk. But so that, you know, be really careful about leverage. Mm-hmm. Let's see, you know, making sure that you're not making assumptions about the future, like rents are going to always go up or home prices are going to always go up in California. I hear that a lot. It's like, oh, just look at history. That's not true. Real estate is cyclical. So owning a property in an area with a lot of different kinds of employers, so lots of employment diversification in an area with enough population, you got to have people, you got to have the jobs. And the people. I like to see an area with 1 million in population at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And then when you're buying in sort of the mid-range affordable area, that I like to be right under the median home price, because I feel like there's enough people in the area that could afford that. So That's basically my foundational principles.
Yeah, yeah, those are great.
Yeah, and if you might have like briefly touched on it, but as the Fed is continuing to raise rates, and we know they're going to meet next week, it seems like it's a very hot topic right now. We'd love to get your input on where you think the economy is going with inflation. We just got the CPI. I saw this morning actually that it ended up going up, if I'm not mistaken, or it was decreasing about 2.3%. Was it? I'm not sure if you saw that statistic.
I didn't see it yet today. I was surfing, trying to forget about it. But
awesome. No, I think it was. I'm getting it confused, but just wanted to see what your take was on that and how you think that's going to affect real estate.
Yeah. And sorry, I don't mean to like throw two questions at you, but before you respond to that part, I've heard you use the analogy of Monopoly when it comes to like the way that the government responded to COVID. And since this is the real estate Monopoly show, I would thought that was like an awesome analogy you could use for this and kind of explain to people that might not be familiar with how that works and the impacts of that. Please, thanks.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is our economy, it's not what you learned in school. The supply demand, of course, that's really important still. But the things that you learn in school, like today, everything is manipulated. And we're so in the backseat of what the Fed's in the driver's seat. They couldn't get their foot off the gas for the last 2 years, creating over $7 trillion, as far as we know, it could have been more, of new money, just dumping $7 trillion of new money into the economy. Now, people might not even know what that means. So it was $7 trillion. We throw it around like it's nothing. Well, it was nearly half of the money in circulation was added, new money. So when you're playing Monopoly, I mean, that's the best way I can describe it. You've got a limited number of houses or apartments on the board, right? And you've got your little fake money, which is really what money is today. It's just only worth something because the government says it is. It's really just paper. So you got your little box and everybody's spread around and everybody's bidding on these limited homes and apartments on the board. And then all of a sudden the banker says, you know what? We need more money. And they bring in another box of money and they spread it around and everybody's got more money bidding against the same apartments. Well, of course you're going to bid it up because you want the apartment, you know, that's the game and you have more money to do it. So the fact that now the Fed is saying, oh, you know, we got to fight inflation. Well, you guys created it. Now you're the one in the driver's seat. You're the one who had your foot on the gas till March of 2022, just 6 months ago, when prices had already gone up over 20% on average in the housing market. And then it's like, oh, we didn't know there'd be inflation. Well, how come I knew it? I don't have access to the data, but people who go, you're going to put in 50% of the money circulating, and yet we didn't build more stuff for people. We didn't create more stuff for people. In fact, we did the opposite. We forced everybody to stay home and not work and not produce, but then you're going to increase the money supply without the goods there. I mean, it's like so obvious and so frustrating. It's like, I'll only say this because I can, I'm old, so I can say things that it's like when I used to get in a car with some young guy with testosterone when I was 16 years old. I get in a car with a 16-year-old driver who's got, you know, he just like ripping through the, you know, like slow down. And then of course there's like this jolt, right? Yeah. That's what it feels like. It's like, can you just drive smoothly? You know, like not too fast, not too slow, just smoothly. That's what the Fed did. And it just, I don't get it. I don't know if it's intentional, but it's the same thing when I was in the mortgage world. It's like, what? You're giving loans to anyone without checking their credit history. You don't care. In fact, you know that they have bad credit. You know they don't pay their bills, but you're still going to give them 100% financing. What? You know, how does that make sense? And it took down the entire world economy, these stupid decisions. Well, here we are again. So you just like, are these people doing it intentionally? Do they like this fast, slow, rough ride? I don't get it. I don't even know how to answer it. And our government's still doing it. They're still printing more money, increasing, you know, let's forgive everybody's loan debt when we already printed too much money. We've already overstimulated, but let's just do a little bit more and see if that helps bring down inflation. No, it's not going to.
So how does this inflationary period right now, how does that kind of add to the testament that people should be investing in assets instead of like saving or holding on to a lot of cash?
Well, it is really extremely sad that if we're in an inflationary environment, hard assets tend to inflate, right? Especially if there's not enough. You know, if there's something, a product, an asset, a hard asset that people want, and there's not enough of it, it goes up with inflation. We don't have enough housing for the number of people who want it. So some areas will continue to see values go up, but some areas are going to see prices go down simply because that's what the Fed's trying to do. They're trying to pull all that money back out of the economy. And the way they do that, it's just the truth. It's through job loss. It's through bankruptcy. It's through stock market collapse. You know, already so much money's out of the market because of a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a very sad and weird manipulated system. I don't understand it. It makes no sense. I wouldn't have made those decisions. I would never have increased the money supply the way they did and then thought we wouldn't see results from that. But that's where we are. So either we got to vote them out or we got to deal with it. I don't know. Yeah, you can't vote out the Federal Reserve, though.
Yeah. And that's why a lot of people, like they talk about not necessarily trying to change the system, but making the most of the opportunities within it.
Yep.
And just understanding, like, I think Tom Wilright always talks about how the tax code is written to incentivize you to do certain things in order to get tax breaks. So like, that's why the wealthy continue to get wealthy and the other sects continue to get poorer, is because they're not understanding that, like, it's a game. You just have to know how to play it. And so
you're right. That's it. I mean, with a hard, okay. So you can still borrow money at 5-6% mm-hmm. when inflation's at 8%. Like right there, all you have to do is the math there. Yeah. Wait, I can borrow money for cheaper than, you know, like you're already making money by borrowing. Yeah. When you borrow money in an inflationary economy, you make money, especially when, you know, 6% might seem high, but it's lower than inflation. Yeah. And you can acquire an asset with that money that then somebody else pays off that loan for you. You're providing housing to people who need it. And you're getting tax benefits for that. Appreciation over time. Mm-hmm. What we know is appreciation or inflation is not transitory. All you have to do is look up US inflation and look at the chart. It has gone up since 1971 when we got off the gold standard and any kind of like weight, you know, any weight on the creation of money, that's gone. You couldn't just print money back then. It had to be tied to the amount of gold that a country had. And then they just let that go in 1971. And it's like, well, we want more money than we have gold. So let's just get rid of the gold standard because that's really holding us back. And ever since then, if you look at the charts, it's been nothing but inflation. So to say it's transitory is ridiculous. So it's here. I mean, all you have to do is like, look at my parents that bought a house for $70,000 in California and it's worth probably 10 million today. That was in my lifetime, like no inflation, like it's here. And so if you don't own the assets that inflate, you are going to be really suffering. So that's why I love what you're explaining is like, look, you can complain all day long, or you can find out how to borrow money and acquire some assets that someone pays off for you. My daughter's young. She's you know, not as young as you guys, but she listened to her mama and she bought a house right out of college. And that house ended up making $150,000 for her. And she was able to buy, awesome. She sold it and then exchange it and bought a house in Southern California. She's a half 15 minutes from one of the most beautiful beaches in California. And she's, you know, 29 and she did it. And I hear all these other people in their 40s saying, oh, you can't afford anything in California. I'm like, well, my daughter did it because she listened to me and she just did it in spite of the fear. She complained the whole way, mom, I'm too young and I don't understand this. And I'm like, you know, by the time you do it, you'll understand it. Yeah. So just do it. You know, just
that
is do
awesome.
It.
Well, that's awesome. It's very inspirational. I really appreciate you sharing that. It is time for our speed round, Kathy. Are you ready?
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Number one, what has been the biggest failure, or what we like to call learning lessons or seminars, throughout your real estate journey? And what did you take away from that experience?
Can you say that question again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. What has been the biggest failure or learning lesson that you've encountered along your real estate journey? And what did you take away from that experience?
I would say the biggest failures I've had, there's been several, was trusting people too much. Trusting people. Most people, when they come into investing, they think that other people are looking out for, you know, their best interest. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that that's not the case when in the real estate world, in the stock market, you know, you've got to look out for yourself. I put way too much trust in people without doing the due diligence that was needed. So make sure that, you know, you just don't trust blindly. I mean, I don't want you to stop trusting people, but make sure that that's not the reason you make decisions. It's because you've done your full due diligence. You've done your inspections. You've done your appraisals. You've looked at, you know, if you're investing in a syndication, you've looked at their background. Have they done this over and over again? Do they have someone on the team with a track record? You know, like, just don't jump into things and sign the dotted line because you like them or because they went to your church.
That's amazing. Second question. What is one thing that you're doing today that you weren't doing when you first got started in real estate and that you wish you would have known at this point?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm kind of doing the same thing that I did 20 years ago. I just wish that's all I did. Mm-hmm. I just wish I'd never veered or strayed from what I know to be the fundamentals, which is looking for cash flow properties and growth markets in the path of progress, where there's lots of new freeways, new hospitals coming in, new schools, and just holding it, just sitting there and holding it, not having to do anything fancy. I got into land construction. I was able to buy land for so cheap in 2010, but I, you know, it's been hard. Construction's been really hard and you don't have a finished product that's cash flowing. So if it goes well, like in the beginning, our investors were making 40% returns. Today, it's really hard. We can't even get them completed. So it would have been so much simpler to just buy, just keep with the plan, just stick with the plan.
That's a great takeaway. And, has there been a major book, one book that has had a big impact on your life in terms of your personal and or business life?
Yeah, so many. I would say back in the beginning, it was the kind of more wealth consciousness books that really changed. Obviously, Rich Dad Poor Dad, but everybody says that. but there were so many books that there was actually the biggest one was an audio book that actually had you do more meditation type, like imagining yourself being wealthy, because until you can do that, you won't create it. Your mind has to be able to see you there first. So I would listen to these tapes and imagine myself every single day, just having the things I want, being able to give to the people I want to, and be able to travel the way I want and live in the home I want. Until your soul accepts that, you won't have it. My husband actually has something called the future self. It's called Future Self. If you go to richfetke.com, or I think also on our Real Wealth site, it's called Future Self. And he'll take you through that process to help you see your future. And once you've got that image, things become a lot easier.
That's amazing. What are some of your long-term goals for your business and long-term vision for the company?
I plan on doing, I'm going to start some retreats and masterminds. A lot of these conferences are great, but it's very surfacey. So I'm wanting to put on 3 to 4 day retreats where people really go deeper and create deep relationships and really learn from each other. So I'll be launching that in 2023 on my kathyfetke.com website.
That's awesome. And do you have anything else, any exciting projects coming up? I know you mentioned TV and you might not be able to talk about it in specific, but I'm just curious.
You know, after this, I'm actually going to be getting on a call with someone who wants me to be on a reality show. So we'll see. You know, I don't want to be too busy, but if it's a good, if it's good, I'll do it. Yeah. I do love being on the market you know, growing that podcast as well.
Fun keeping up with the Fetkes.
Yeah.
There you go. I really want to do Malibu HOA because we own a condo and you just can't even imagine the characters. So I would love to do that reality show, Malibu HOA.
I love it. Kathy, you shared a ton of wisdom today. I really appreciate it. But if there was one piece of advice that you would want our audience to walk away with from today's episode, what would that be?
It would be to just don't listen to headlines. They are meant to scare you. That is the whole point. When I was in the news business, we had to come up with headlines that would get your attention. And the way you do that is you scare people. So just know that's what they're doing. Dig into the article, read it, and find out how they're lying to you, because the headline is usually the opposite. So just get the data and the facts and don't listen to the hype and the drama.
Yeah, I think I heard you say one time, if it doesn't bleed, it won't lead.
If it bleeds, it leads. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It always had to be murders and fires. I'm like, can't we just cover something else? Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for being here, Kathy. I really appreciate it. If anyone in our audience wants to learn more about you or just follow you on your journey, where can they go to do that?
Realwealth.com is where you can learn all about the different markets and get connected with teams that can help you find investment property. And then grow your real estate. Growdevelopments.com is where you can find out about my syndications.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being here, Kathy. It was a pleasure chatting with you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you guys.
Likewise. And thank you everyone for tuning in today to the Real Estate Monopoly. Please make sure to leave a 5-star review and a comment down below. Jeff, where can they find us?
At Donis Brothers on all platforms. And then feel free to check us individually out on all social media platforms as well at Jeffrey Donis
and Donis Kerwin. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in today. Let's get out there and take action. Have a great rest of your day.